You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. In the background, Bob Dylan, Gotta Serve Somebody. A delegation of the World Health Organization will visit Iraq today to study the environmental and health effects of depleted uranium ammunition used during the Persian Gulf War by the U.S. and Britain. The delegation will stay in Iraq till the end of the month. Iraqi health officials and international human rights groups have criticized the U.S. and its Western allies for dropping hundreds of tons of DU bombs in southern Iraq during the Gulf War, leading to what they say has been an environmental disaster. Iraqi doctors also blame the depleted uranium bombs for the sharp increase of cancer cases since the war, including a nearly five-fold increase in the rates of childhood cancers. Iraq has demanded compensation from the U.S. and Britain for their use of DU ammunition during the Gulf War. In related news, a U.S.-British airstrike on a radar station in southern Iraq Saturday wounded one person, according to the official Iraqi news agency. The news from Iraq comes as anti-sanctions activists continue in their fourth week of a 40-day fast outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations to protest economic sanctions against Iraq, which have killed more than a million Iraqi civilians. 22 people have been arrested in actions at the UN surrounding the fast, including 10 last week. Among the fasters is Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, based in Chicago, and two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. We had you with us at the beginning of your fast. It's now, what, day 22?
That's right.
And what do you feel you've accomplished? How has it been standing outside the U.S. mission?
Well, it's always very interesting to have interaction with people working for the U.S. mission. The theme of this fast is breaking ranks, and it's fairly clear, I think, to anyone who's passed by us working for the U.N. that we think that's potential, that they could break ranks with policies that are clearly murderous. And we're also very conscious that they are preparing for a huge gathering that will celebrate and demonstrate the conclusion of 10 years of focus on the rights of children. The UN has put enormous effort into guaranteeing the rights of children all around the world, but we want to say there's one glaring, huge oversight, and that's the rights of children in Iraq. What about those children against whom war has been waged at the hands of the United Nations?
A bunch of people were arrested last week. What did they do?
Well, we went over to the steps of the U.S. mission to the U.N., carrying a very simple meal, lentils and untreated water from the East River and rice. And we've invited members of the U.S. mission to the U.N. staff to just come down, initiate some kind of dialogue with us about these very deep concerns we have, and if they will, share the meal. Certainly we wouldn't ask them to drink the water. We've been told we have no business to conduct on the steps of the U.S. mission to the U.N., but we think that this is by far the most important thing possible on their agenda, to take a look at the concerns we're raising. The European Parliament just received a draft report of 56 paragraphs about the situation in Iraq. Now, Hans von Stoneck and the head of Caritas International and Mark Bossert, a very well-renowned international lawyer, have found that 26 paragraphs of that report are full of errors and are misleading, and as they say in a letter, tendentious. We want to raise these things. This is UN business, and it's business directly pertinent to the U.S. mission because it's the one that mainly insists on maintenance of these deadly sanctions.
Hmm. We had on a reporter last week from the Progressive magazine, Thomas Nagy, who broke the story on documents that have been released by the National Security Archives that show that the United States actually deliberately contaminated the water supply of Iraq.
And I wonder how that can be characterized as anything other than biological warfare. To read that report is absolutely chilling because you can see definite paragraph stipulations about what the consequences of the deprivation of Iraqis of the materials they need would be, and they tell exactly what diseases, and it's like looking into a crystal ball. This was issued in 1991, and it all unfolded. Cholera, typhus, dysentery, diarrhea afflicting the children.
How can you think so clearly after 22 days fasting?
No, really, you end up having a little bit more clarity, I think.
No, I don't. You do. I'm looking at yesterday's Chicago Tribune. It's in a column called American Stories, A Passionate Voice in the Wilderness. It's by Karen Rivadal, and it starts, how does an ordinary girl from Chicago's South Side, who once thought about being a nun, grow up to become a tax cheat, ex-con, and government critic so vocal and passionate that a federal agency more likely to monitor terrorists and drug traffickers has her in its sights as well? How did you grow up to be such a person?
Well, I think I talked myself into part of it, really by being a Catholic high school religion teacher, I suppose. I mean, there are plenty of ideals that would lead most people in this country to want to take payment for weapons, nuclear weapons, biological weapons, chemical weapons, economic sanctions, out of their personal budget. And I did that since 1980. I haven't paid any taxes to the United States government. I just won't pay for weapons and warfare. And I suppose that's an everyday action of civil disobedience, and it does lead you along a trail of thinking, well, if you won't pay for them, then what are you going to do when people start to use them? And that's led some of us into various war zones. But I think, more importantly, in a sense, every poor neighborhood in this country is a war zone. It's a refugee camp for the class wars in this country, as Dorothy Day once said. And so it's really a very ordinary, everyday set of tasks and directions that I think are before people who decide that they're not going to be accomplices to murder.
You started your activism, or at least you first got arrested around a nuclear weapons site?
No, actually draft registration had just been put back in by President Jimmy Carter, and I was arrested 5 times singing an old Irish song, "They're Rolling Out the Guns Again," in the post office. I got it for disorderly conduct.
And what happened with the nuclear missiles?
Well, we decided to plant corn on top of the nuclear missile silo sites. We believe so much that land is meant to grow corn and wheat and never to harbor weapons of mass destruction. So we climbed the fences, planted corn, and that was worth a year in maximum security prison.
Where?
Lexington, Kentucky.
And so how did you end up focusing on Iraq? I hesitate to say setting your sights on, but for the last 10 years, you're really the preeminent activist on this issue, highlighting U.S. sanctions against Iraq.
Well, Voices started in 1996 really as the result of 8 people putting their heads together. It happened to be around my kitchen table. But my own introduction to Iraq was in going to Iraq as part of a peace team on the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq. We were parked on the Iraq side of the border during the first 14 days of the Gulf War and then evacuated to Baghdad. I honestly knew so little about the Middle East. It was presumptuous, in a sense, for me to go there, but I did know that I wanted to be a pacifist and give the most vigorous opposition to that war. I, like others, let that war slide to the back burners, 92, 93, 94, but by the end of 95, the UN statistics were so overwhelming. I mean, over 500,000 children under age 5, this is the United Nations counting, lost their lives because of these sanctions. So there just wasn't any question, there still isn't, about walking away from this issue. That's why we're collecting petition sheets that Hans von Sponeck will help us deliver October 24th, and very much wanting to kind of pull the coattails of all the people working with the UN, and also if this message can get beyond the United States to people in other countries who could do more to influence the United States to stop a policy that's unsustainable.
You also had the former Assistant Secretary General, Dennis Halliday, who, along with Hans von Sponeck, was head of the Oil for Food program in Iraq, both quit, saying it was genocidal. He was standing outside the U.S. mission with you. What was the response to a man who'd been inside the U.N. for more than 2 decades?
Well, you really have to ask how many former Assistant Secretary Generals of the United Nations who once ran the entire human rights program and had a huge staff and quite a lot of privilege and prestige would be sitting on a milk crate across from their former place of employment. I found it so brave. He's really and truly a person of conscience, as is Hans von Sponeck. There are people who certainly feel troubled by the breaking ranks that's personified by these two, and because it demonstrates that it's always a potential that people can act according to their consciences. There's a price, but I think Dennis Halliday's willingness to pay that price certainly sets a standard, and we hope that standard goes all the way up to the Secretariat's office, to Mr. Kofi Annan as well.
What is the response of the various delegations who have to pass you to go to the United Nations or go into the U.S. mission?
Well, many ask, so now how long are you going to do this? And they're very conscious of what day we're on. There's some solicitous concern for our health, I think. We churn out a new leaflet every day, and some say they now have a collection of these leaflets on their desks, and others have pictures of former voices' actions on their walls. And some have said that their guess is that 170 of the 186 member states of the UN agree with us, but that there is a bit of fear. Even coming to talk to us can be an occasion of a little concern. People might not want someone looking out the window to see them doing that. But I feel very confident about this staff. I think that we've taken an action that's beyond reproach in approaching the U.S. mission to the UN with a simple meal of lentils and rice and asking them either to talk with us or break fast with us. We're doing something that's understandable, it's reasonable, given the terrible, terrible bloodshed and loss of life that's happened in Iraq today.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, founder of Voice in the Wilderness, and day 22 of her 40-day fast outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations. World Health Organization has a group that has gone to Iraq today to start investigating depleted uranium. You've been to Iraq numerous times in the last 10 years. What is the effect of depleted uranium that you have seen?
Mostly what I experience is the palpable fear of parents. I had a chance to be in a birthing room once as 10 women were simultaneously giving birth to babies, and I'm sure every mother says, is my baby okay? But these mothers were not only asking, is the baby okay? The next question was deformities, and they checked the babies rapidly. People don't know. No one can know right now what the effects of this depleted uranium might be, but they do know that there are rising incidences of childhood cancers, of deformities, of adult tumors that have never been seen before. Doctors themselves think that they are at risk as well as anyone else. And this research finally is starting, but what a long delay in greatly needed research. It will be years before conclusions can actually be drawn. And in that interim time, fear and anxiety, and these are always the products of experimenting with new weapons.
Another bombing of Iraq this weekend by U.S. and British forces. You have been there when the U.S. has bombed. Can you explain how this happens? It's almost become a ritual, except that people are sacrificed in the process.
Right. What doesn't even barely make the news in our country is also becoming everyday. Quite honestly, the air raid sirens go off and people just look over their shoulders and shrug. The little girls will make a sound. They go to drown out the sounds of the airplanes going overhead. But this isn't to say that civilian lives aren't lost. And particularly when we think of a little young shepherd boy that was decapitated while he was minding his flocks, he kind of personifies to us the risk that so many people are at. There's absolutely no justification under Resolution 688, UN resolution, for the no-fly zones. There's nothing that calls for that setup.
Explain how it works.
Well, the United States says that according to a United Nations document that calls for the protection of Iraqi people should the Iraqi government undertake an attack, the United States says that that justifies U.S. overflights on the southern and the northern portions of Iraq every day, sometimes three or four times a day. And if Iraqi radar, and this is a sovereign country, if it locks on to a U.S. plane going overhead, the U.S. then ostensibly bombs the radar installation or bombs the telecommunication facility. But quite often, they've bombed civilian homes, and I stayed in such a home last summer over 7 weeks' time. We got to know the people very well. They've bombed shepherds. They bombed a soccer field, allegedly. We're not sure how that one actually occurred. But there have been now close to 322 people who've lost their lives because of these bombings.
Yeah, the way the media describes it, it's always the same thing. It says the U.S. bombed a radar facility.
In self-defense.
Explain that.
Well, the U.S. claims that if the radar facility locks on a U.S. plane, the pilot is in jeopardy. But, of course, people all around the world who are far more aware of the gross violation of international law that this constitutes are in a sense, astounded that the U.S. would claim that their pilots are in jeopardy and must act in self-defense. There's no call for these pilots to fly over in the first place. And, in fact, in the northern no-fly zone, when pilots take off from Incirlik base in Turkey, if they discover that the Turkish government, in fact, wants to go and kill Kurdish people in that region on a particular day, then the overfly U.S. pilots are called back or told not to fly that day. And it's common knowledge that the Turkish government goes into Iraq with great regularity and either displaces or kills Kurdish people.
What are your plans for this week?
Well, we have an opportunity for me to return to Chicago while still fasting and talk to 5,000 to 6,000 Muslim people at the Islamic Scholars Convention in Chicago. So I'm hoping that I won't quake and turn into a half-wit at the size of such an audience. We also have Bishop Gumbelton joining us on Wednesday, and we'll again take our meal of lentils and rice over to the U.S. mission to the U.N., so I expect I'll be in the lockup Wednesday and Thursday, and hope that they will release me on time to be on a flight to Chicago. And then we're going to welcome some other people that are coming from various parts of the country, and it's a huge welcome. We're very lucky to have space at St. Vincent Ferrer Parish in Brooklyn, and quite a good community has formed, and it's been just a real privilege to have people like Bishop Gumbelton join us.
For those people who are in New York and who are listening right now, where can they go to see you?
Well, we're having free speech day at the UN of our own devices. They can see us with balloons at 45th Street and 1st Avenue. The balloons say sanctions kill and reinflate Iraq's economy, and we'll be wearing a message on T-shirts. That seems to be the best way to get free speech day accomplished at the 45th Street and 1st Avenue intersection across from the U.S. mission to the UN.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. You said you put out a flyer every day. If people want to go to the web, can they see these different flyers?
Well, we're not quite that scannable at St. Vincent Ferrer Parish, but if they want to buy St. Vincent's a scanner, we'll work on it.
The website for Voices
Thank
in the Wilderness.
Thank you so much. Right, that's www.vitw, like Voices in the Wilderness, or vitamin W, .org. And we'll be very happy to stay in touch with folks.
Well, Kathy Kelly, thanks very much for joining us. It's hard to believe it's day 22 of your fast.
Well, great to be in this particular spot.
Well, I want to thank you again, Kathy Kelly, who now heads up to the United Nations. This particular spot is the firehouse. It's Engine Company 31 in Chinatown. What better place to be in the midst of a firestorm than here? You're listening to Democracy Now! When we return, we're going to be joined by the founder of Downtown Community Television, DCTV, where we are right now. And we're going to talk about the media blockade on places like Iraq. He was one of the first to get footage of the effects of the bombing of Iraq. That's inside Iraq. How come it didn't play on NBC, CBS, but played throughout the rest of the world? And we'll talk about its effects as well as other places he's gone. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Curtis Stiggers in the background. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Well, it's taken over 10 years for the U.S. public to become even remotely aware of the impact of economic sanctions in Iraq. Activists working to end the sanctions have often wondered, how has this sort of suffering been allowed to continue almost unnoticed in this country? No matter how many times someone like Kathy Kelly goes to Iraq, it's almost impossible to break through the information blockade and what's happening on the ground. We can trace this back to the media coverage of the Persian Gulf War. John Alpert was the first journalist on the ground to bring back pictures of the bombing inside Iraq. While originally he was supposed to be going for NBC News, it turns out his dramatic video footage never aired in the United States, although it did make it on television around Europe and won the Italian Peace Prize. John is an independent reporter who's regularly broken stories and brought back groundbreaking footage from Cuba to the Philippines under Marcos, Yugoslavia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and other places. He joins us now to share his war stories and how difficult it is to get these stories on the ground. Yes, there's stories of war around the world, but also the war he's had to wage with the major networks to air the footage. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John Alfred.
Hi. Well, thanks. You know, unfortunately, this is a story that, you know, I it's just really sad that we have to tell it because it's still continuing today in the same way that some of the things that you need to talk with people about are being kept off the airwaves. This was an important story, and it dealt with a war that the United States basically was prosecuting, and the American people had very, very little information.
Explain how you were starting to go to Iraq under NBC's auspices and what happened.
Well, as the war began to unfold, we were waving our hand up in the air going, call on me, call on me. We're ready to go over and participate in the coverage of the war. This was a war that for most reporters was fairly easy to cover because they spent it in air-conditioned hotel rooms in Saudi Arabia, standing on the balconies as the war was unfolding hundreds of miles away and pretending that they were quite brave. So there wasn't a lot of room for people like me to go over and cover the war, and I was basically kept out of NBC's coverage in the beginning. But when the bombing actually started in Baghdad, all the reporters there except for Peter Arnett decided that it was a good idea to get out of the country, and they left, and this created a news vacuum. And so I said to NBC News, well, we can get in. Of course, I didn't have the slightest idea if we could get in or not, but I told them that we could get in. And they said, well, if you can get in, give it a shot. And in fact, after about a week of lobbying, the Iraqis decided that they would give us visas. So I informed NBC News about this, and they said, that's great. That afternoon, I got a phone call from Ramsey Clark. Now, I had never spoken to Ramsey Clark in my life. I had heard about him, but I really wasn't that familiar with him. And he said, John, I'm going into Iraq tomorrow. Want to go with me? This sped things up by a few days. And so I decided, gee, that's a great idea. The people at NBC News said, that's fine. And actually, I was standing at the gate on my way to board the plane when I got a phone call from the vice president of NBC News who ordered me not to go to Iraq. We had a little bit of a discussion at that particular point. I told him that that it was imperative that reporters go, that the people in the United States didn't have any information. See, along with all the rest of the public, I had been watching the generals on TV with their computer diagrams describe how accurate their bombs were. And I remember one news conference, the general said in response to a question that every single one of their bombs, 100%, were completely accurate, that they had not damaged a civilian target and that nobody had died, no civilians had died. And I just thought that was preposterous. I had been to about 7 or 8 wars, and I knew that that's not war. The vice president told me that I couldn't go, and I said, you can't stop me. It's important.
Who was the vice president?
I can't even remember what his name is right now. I mean, this guy had spent a decade trying to keep me, and I guess it's probably a psychological block. I can't remember his name right now. I think Edwards is his last name. I'll remember it by the end of the program. And I said, you can't stop me. I'm going anyway. I had a problem at that particular point because I had dressed myself all up in NBC clothes, basically for my own identity and protection. NBC had NBC shirt, NBC this. I had to gaffer tape over the NBC in order to now become an independent reporter. And we spent a week in Iraq basically trying to find out what was really happening.
You got film?
Well, we got film, I don't want to give away too many of our secrets, basically by tricking the Iraqi censors. There was a very strange, unholy alliance at this time. The American government was trying to keep the truth of the war from the American people, but the Iraqi government was really doing the same thing. Both sides were pretending that there was no civilian casualty, nobody was dying. Saddam didn't want to panic his population, and he basically was pretending that they could take everything that the United States government was unleashing and nobody was getting hurt. And as a result, he was trying to keep the reporters from seeing the civilian death and damage as well. But because of our experience in war zones, we knew certain routes around the censorship, and we took advantage of this. And after a week, we had done a fairly thorough job of documenting death, destruction, people's houses being bombed, and I wanted to get that footage back to the United States. I snuck the tapes out of the country in my sock.
And you brought it back to the United States.
I brought it back to the United States, and NBC News looked at this and decided that this was very important and that this would be NBC News' lead story, and they were going to show the civilian deaths and destruction that our bombs were causing.
And this was in the midst of the bombing, so you'd not only get those well-known Pentagon pictures of the target on some unknown site on the ground, but you'd have it from the bottom up.
Right. And we were here in this very building that we're speaking from editing this story. And at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I get a phone call telling me that not only is NBC News not going to broadcast this story, but that I'm never going to work for NBC News again. This is it. They're firing me. They didn't broadcast the tapes. And they fired me.
On what grounds?
They said that any time I go to the third world, I make trouble. And they were tired of this type of trouble, and this would be a good point to stop it.
Now, CBS took a look, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. I was working on that story with Marianne DeLeo, a very brave fellow reporter. We were in Iraq together, and we sort of were sitting around there moping around, some part selfishly because this was possibly the end of many years of work. But also, we had gone to extraordinary lengths, took risks, because we thought it was important for us to bring the truth to the public, and we couldn't. We had no way of getting the news out. So we said, well, maybe another network would have the courage to broadcast this, and we called up CBS, and we wound up 30 minutes later over at the office of the executive producer of their evening news. And he watched the tape, and he was astonished. And he said, this is amazing. The American people should know about this. I will make this my lead story tomorrow night. Wow, we felt great. We're going to get the truth out and also get to kick in NBC's teeth at the same time. And we imagined that for the next decade, NBC would be feeling sorry for itself every time we scooped their reporters. And so this was not only the opportunity to tell the truth, but also vindication. Unfortunately, that night at 2 o'clock in the morning, the gentleman, the executive director of their news who had made the decision to broadcast our report, he was fired at 2 o'clock in the morning. He got a phone call. So we didn't get on the air at CBS.
Who was he?
He's Tom Battag. He's a nice guy. Tom Battag is now the executive producer of Nightline. Tom thinks that it's just a coincidence that he was fired that night. Kind of strange that they would call him in the middle of the night and fire him. He's kind of nervous every time I call him with a story because he sort of associates me with the loss of his job. And he's done a fairly innovative job at Nightline working with independents. He gives independents a chance. He's one of the few executive producers who does that. But he lost his job. So we lost our job. He lost his job. Nobody in the United States would touch this footage during the war. McNeil Air, I mean, I thought they were going to hide under the desk when I walked into the room with this. ABC has a little bit better excuse. They were on the verge of getting one of their reporters into the country. So they used that as the reason why they didn't broadcast it, but never got on the air.
We're talking to John Alpert. He is a crusading independent reporter, has won 6 Emmy Awards. And
I won more than that, Amy.
7.
I won more than that.
8.
11.
11 awards.
I think I won 11. They're down. We have to count them.
I counted
in the
wrong downstairs. as well as a number of other awards. Now, your video footage did get out, just not in the United States.
That's correct. It played extensively in Europe. I did win the Italian Peace Prize. I got to meet, I can't remember whether it was the president or the prime minister, because they have so many of those. I can't keep track, but I got to meet one of them. I don't want to make a joke about this.
But it did get out.
It got out every place except the United States. But these other countries weren't bombing. It was our country that was bombing. And the people in the United States were kept in the dark about some of the consequences of this bombing.
Can you talk, John, about preventive buying. We had a discussion last night, and you were telling me the story in relation to your getting footage in Cuba. Talk about that experience.
Well, this is a real old story, AB. This was back in 1974, and we had just come back from Cuba. We were the first TV reporters, possibly since the beginning of the revolution, to get into Cuba. And we were quite inexperienced. We didn't really know what we had in our hands, but we were quite excited that we had the makings of a documentary about Cuba. And I got a call from CBS, and they looked at my footage, and they said, "Great, how much you want for it?" And I said, "Well, what are you going to?" He said, "How much are you selling this footage for?" And I said, "Well, what are you going to do with it?" And he says, "I'm not answering questions. I'm asking the questions, and the question that I'm wanting to answer, how much are you going to sell this for?" I said, "But I need to know what you're going to do with it." He says, "You don't understand. What's the price? I want to buy this footage. I'm not telling you. I want to know what you're going to sell it for." And I really needed the money. We were broke. And I said, "I'm sorry, but unless I know what you're doing with the footage, it's not for sale." And what I didn't know at the time is that CBS was in the process of getting Dan Rather into Cuba, and they wanted to be the first. And my footage was in the way. And they wanted to buy it and put it in the closet. And they had done this on other projects.
Preventive buying,
not so that they can be the first to put something on the air, but they can make sure that it doesn't get on the air so that they can take full credit for a journalistic coup.
Huh. There are a lot of other stories I'd like to talk to you about. For example, Yugoslavia, when you followed Jesse Jackson when he was going to release, get some U.S. servicemen released. Also, this past Friday night, you were part of a two-hour CBS special. They didn't tell the stories you just told, called Breaking the News. It was you, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, Christiane Amanpour, the reporters, they said, who are, you know, on the edge, who are out there, and you were in with all of them. It's funny, in the elevator coming up this morning, I saw the little flyer that's up here that says John Alpert and the lesser reporters who are out there. But the footage of yours was quite astounding, and it was only a second. And I'd like to talk with that with you tomorrow about the Philippines under Marcos and how you went with the National Liberation Army and covered a guerrilla attack, which was very controversial in this country, how you were there on the ground and what you should have done as a reporter. Should you have alerted the Philippines Army? That's how the controversy was framed. But I also want to talk to you about this place we're in right now, which is DCTV. And, folks, we've talked about it every day, downtown community television. And the minute we have left, John, at the same time you've gone around the country, around the world, bringing footage of what's happening on the ground, you have set up this center in the United States, in New York, in the midst of Chinatown, to give people, particularly young people, access to learn how to use video to tell their own stories. When did you found DCTV?
We started it, myself and Keiko Tsuno started in 1972. So next year is our 30th anniversary.
And the idea of the place?
Well, the idea, we began showing our videotapes from an old mail truck that I bought for $5 at an auction. We showed the tapes on the streets in Chinatown. If the people liked the tapes, they stood around and watched, and if they didn't like them, they walked away. We had an empty sidewalk. But we were able to use our tapes to fight for better schools in the neighborhood, to improve our hospitals. And we began training people to also do this work. We felt that just by ourselves, we could make maybe only one tape a month, one tape a year. But if we had other people working with us, if they had classes, if we could give them the equipment, then lots of people could do this work. And we saw the changes that media in the people's hands can do. And that's why we have this center.
I want to talk about some of those projects tomorrow as well. You're also in the midst of a PBS project where you're documenting the mayoral candidates in New York. That's going to be airing just before the primary.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm having a lot of fun. It's called Campaign Confidential, The Men Who Would Be Mayor. And we're following the major candidates as they run for office. Me in the car with them, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. it's really fascinating to see the differences in their personalities, what they believe in, and we think that this is actually going to be a very influential program. It's going to be on the night before the vote, September 10th at 8 o'clock on Channel 13. It's been a lot of fun working on that.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, John Alpert, and I hope you don't mind waking up early again tomorrow.
No, and it's our pleasure to have you here working with us in the firehouse.
Well, it's been quite an experience, and I really appreciate it. I want to thank everyone who's helped with today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Special thanks to Miranda Kennedy and Chase Pearson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We are broadcasting from DCTV. DCTV is Downtown Community Television. We're in Engine House 31 in Chinatown. We're in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners. Also want to acknowledge our technical director, Errol Maitland, who's with WBIX.org, and all of the Pacifica stations, particularly KPFA, and our Pacifica affiliates. We are Pacifica. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.